Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I'm your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Every week, we want to have honest conversations about what it means to be in one of the sector's least understood, yet most critical roles. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to remind everyone that my four fundraising frameworks are available to your organization. All you've got to do is go to my website, click on the toolbox, and download this free resource. Inside the toolbox, you will find four frameworks, 1, 2, 3, 4, that will help your organization ensure that everyone understands how fundraising really works. Not quite so sure what I'm talking about, you will have a framework for distinguishing between fundraising cultures, a planning framework that ensures your fundraising efforts are responsive to the opportunities available to your organization, a campaign planning framework for any major fundraising initiative, and as if that's not enough, how about a KPI scorecard that combines my fascination with the science of expertise with your determination to raise more money? If you'd like to download this free resource, go to my website, lewisfundraising.com/toolbox. Again, that's lewisfundraising.com/toolbox. I'll also put a link in the show notes. But without further ado, I do want to introduce my guest. Daphne Powell is the Director of Donor Relations at Birmingham Southern College, where she is reinventing the college's donor relations program. Daphne has spent 19 years in the development office at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, developing, implementing, and overseeing the comprehensive program for gift acknowledgement, recognition, and reporting. She describes herself as a donor, a nonprofit advocate, and a believer in mentoring others in the profession. Daphne, delighted to have you on today. We're going to continue the conversation that I had earlier this week with Randy.
Thanks, Jason. Thank you for the great introduction. I appreciate that. I have 20 years of donor relations experience now. I am a charter member and former board officer of the Association of Donor Relations Professionals. And I've done some speaking here and there relative to donor relations and stewardship. In fact, I'll be presenting at the ADRP International Conference in Miami in September. And you'll probably love the title of my presentation, which is From Mess to Money. I believe that... you have your three lanes with the messy middle, and I'm looking forward to talking about that with you today.
Yeah, so we're talking about this fiasco that's sort of playing out at the University of Alabama. So most of my listeners probably heard the earlier broadcast earlier this week where we talked to Randy, who sort of shared his thoughts about that. But before we begin to sort of unravel your opinions about how that's playing out, Daphne, would you mind just summarizing it for us, for anyone who hasn't, who's not familiar with the story?
Sure. So the University of Alabama has a major donor who's given money over the years, a family, in fact, who has given money. Their business school is named for Hugh Culverhouse Sr., who left a large estate gift to the university and was an alumnus of the university. His son has also been involved, and recently, and when I say recently, it was last September, announced a $26.5 million pledge to the law school, and the university decided to rename the law school, not just the building, but the law school, in honor of Hugh Culverhouse Jr. And there was a statement released by Hugh Culverhouse Jr., and I believe that a quote I read this morning said that he used a divisive and sensitive issue as a, I guess, quote, cover-up, and was very distasteful in the manner in which he presented his opinion. He basically called for a boycott of the university, and he really beat the university to the punch. In my personal opinion is that Mr. Culverhouse retaliated before the university was able to take his name off of the law school. And because he had already asked for $10 million back. And just yesterday, the university released emails that showed that they were already in discussions about returning his gift prior to his opinion piece being released to the public. So I think he maybe saw the handwriting on the wall when he chose to do what he did. But it has been a very public confrontation between donor and institution. And nothing like it, of which I'm aware, has ever happened in the university's history like this in the entire university system, which includes three campuses. So it's definitely an interesting case to discuss.
Yeah, so I think I didn't get a chance to read it, but there was a Washington Post article where he, I think I just saw this yesterday come across, and I didn't get a chance to read it, but where Culverhouse came out and sort of told his side of the story. Am I right? Did you see that?
I did, yes. And he made some statements in there that when the university released the emails showed that those statements were not totally truthful.
Yeah.
Forthcoming.
Yeah. So you heard mine and Randy's conversation earlier this week, and I sort of summarized my thoughts just around this notion of the messy middle. Everything that I'm generally teaching is this notion that there's essentially three lanes playing out in any fundraising operation, be it large or small, and that I think too many organizations are not taking the time or making the appropriate investment in that messy middle lane. I think too often we're literally going from, as I said, I think with Randy earlier this week, I think too many organizations are jumping from Giving Tuesday or their give day to a, you know, Mr. Donor or Mrs. Donor, will you give us $1 million? And I think that's just too much of a leap to go from a relatively trivial gift to something as significant as a seven or even eight figure gift in some cases. We've got to be better at investing in the middle. And I have to imagine, Daphne, as a donor relations professional, you have to feel similar. What are your thoughts about all this?
Yes. So yeah, I love the three lanes, from wining and dining to closure, basically, of the gift. You've got the messy middle. And many times in that messy middle, you don't have the right stakeholders. And, you know, I don't know in this situation if that was the case here, but everybody who has a part in the play needs to be at the table to learn the script. And that script, in this case, being the gift agreement and the obligations that were being made on behalf of the university. Well, the messy middle also quite often does not involve donor relations. Donor relations needs to be at the table from start to finish, and they need to be there to help motivate those donors to move up in their giving. The person I consider to be the queen of donor relations, Penelope Burke, her studies have shown that donors will give again to a charity that thanks them promptly and in a personal way and follows up later with a meaningful report on how those gifts are used. So if you build those relationships over time, you will have that middle may not be quite so messy. You might not need a vacuum, just a little dustbuster.
Right.
Yeah. And I mean, do you agree with the notion that we have to have, I mean, I was sharing with you before we hit the record button, I just got off a coaching call with one of my major gift officers. And I was explaining to her this idea that there's oftentimes playing out in the lives of our donors, a series of gifts. And it would seem to me, and maybe this is your team, your donor relations team that would sort of see and understand this. It would seem to me like there was probably or could have been a series of gifts that would have afforded the organization a level of discernment to know that, hey, if we take a $20 million gift and put this fella's name on a building, it could end up getting us in trouble. Am I right?
Well, yes and no, I guess. It depends. He had been a longtime donor. I don't know how involved he has been in the past and whether he has been what we might consider in the profession high maintenance.
Right, okay, yeah.
but there comes a point where if someone really wants to say, this is my money and I want the vision to be this and not that, were the appropriate conversations had regarding that shared vision to begin with? And is the donor just upset or have you alienated them? You know, in this case, we all see that there's alienation here and there's no way to mend those particular broken fences. I think that bridge is on fire.
So does a person what is a position from a donor relations posture? And honestly, I have to admit, I haven't talked to a lot of people that sort of in that very specialized sort of, they would consider themselves sort of specialized in that particular space. Are you a fan, for example, of putting people's names on a building?
The living individuals, can sometimes be problematic. It depends on the relationship there. I think that it would be a judgment call based on that relationship. For example, a longtime donor at UAB, where I used to work, has been involved with the School of Business, now the Collat School of Business, from the very beginning of the school. And he was never overly involved. He was very supportive in every way he could be. And he has made a major, not only major outright gift, but planned gift to name that college. I'm okay with that. I think that it's very deserving and he should be recognized for all he has done while he's alive and before he is gone. But there are a lot of institutions who strictly will only name buildings in memory of someone. And if they're doing it in honor of someone, they're contributions to the institution must be very overwhelming and outstanding. I know that from experience that the University of Alabama system has all of those rules in place. And I know that they use gift agreements. Now, whether that gift agreement was vetted properly or, again, if all the stakeholders were at the table when that gift agreement was being formalized, that's a huge question. Only they can answer that, and they can, or, you know, the reporters can certainly ask for that gift agreement if they want to. I have not seen a copy of it yet. But I have worked with donors as well, a major foundation that has given a total of $26 million to the McKnight Brain Research Institute at UAB, and that is $26 million, and they've been involved on a consultation basis, and consultation can be a very gray area, but they've not been too overly involved where they're trying to manage day-to-day operations and hiring and firing of employees and things of that nature.
So I'm not a big fan of the contractual. I guess I'm just too much of a relationship guy. I'm not a fan of the contractual, the idea, for example, that a gift agreement could have, I can't imagine, Daphne, that a gift agreement could have prevented this? Because here's a guy who's, I mean, if he, anybody who's capable of writing $20 million gifts, right? Contributing $20 million gifts and putting their name on a building at a major university has got to have a platform that in the midst of a very divisive issue as what we're talking about in the state of Alabama, this guy's going to have an opinion about it. And it's, there's always going to be a chance that an institution like the University of Alabama is going to be at odds with one of their major donors of this sort. You can't put in a, maybe you can, and you tell me if you can, you can't put in a gift agreement the idea that, that their opinions are squashed, or that they have to check the, you know, that you have to check your public opinion with the institution before you voice it, right?
No, I'm sorry. The emails that they released showed that the decision was made prior to his original opinion piece being made, that this had nothing to do, that the decision to return the gift had absolutely nothing to do with his political stance and his personal opinion. So I think that's important to stay say because he wants us to believe that. But because the emails strictly, I mean specifically the emails were back and forth 4 days prior to his piece being released. So he's almost like someone else we know that doesn't like to be told no.
Right. So, what does this mean? So let's go real high level about this one. What does this mean for philanthropy? I mean, what if you're a major donor right now, and it doesn't even matter if you're in the state of Alabama and you're thinking about writing a check to a big university, and you may be on either side of this, you know, that the whether you're on the side of Culverhouse and on his and his issue with the recent legislation, some of that doesn't even sort of matter. But what does this mean for bigger the bigger idea of philanthropy and generosity and giving? What does all that mean, do you think?
Yes. So I think that donors have great expectations and that it's important for the institutions to be clear about what those expectations are and whether they can meet those expectations. You definitely don't want to get into a power control issue with any of your donors, no matter the size of the gift. I mean, I have seen, and for the most part, donors are, let me say right up front, donors are very, they have generous spirits. And the reason they give is because of the joy that they receive from that giving and the impact of those gifts, not because they can control things. But I have seen donors of every from 2,000 to a million who want to control how those gifts are dispersed. And you really have to be clear about charitable intent and what charitable intent means. It's a matter of educating the donor about not only IRS rules and regulations, but just what it means to have a servant's spirit. So, yes, and it's just outlining everything in detail. I think the gift agreement is more for the donor than for the institution. It is to make sure that the institution understands the purpose of those gifts and carries out those wishes. I've also seen where there were no gift agreements in place and the money was used haphazardly and not maybe sort of for the intended purpose, but it might be a stretch to link it back to the intended purpose. So, and that's not to say that's been at any institution that I've been personally involved with. I just have known of those situations.
Yeah, so I mean, there's this. I mean, one of the things I was sharing with Randy, and you heard this when I was talking with there's this story playing out at the University of Chicago right now, where you've got two very generous individuals who contributed to a particular program. Interestingly, ironically, the program was sort of an international conflict resolution program. and they can't, you know, so obviously they can't get along with you know, maybe they need to do some more local conflict resolution because internationally doesn't seem to be the problem. But in this case, it's not a big divisive political issue sort of at the center of all this, but it's just the simple administration of the particular gift. And that does get to your point about the gift agreement. These two brothers, are saying that essentially the money was not being spent according to plan and that people were not hired according to the, this particular institute that was supposed to be funded, which certainly could have been much more explicitly or maybe wasn't as explicit enough in the gift agreement, and therefore expectations were not. So what would you have done differently? What would you have, if you were at the center of this and this was yours to completely administrate and you having all the assumptions you're making about the way this is playing out, what would you have done differently?
Well, first of all, let me say for the Chicago business, I would have made sure that the time horizon on those obligations and expectations were clearly defined in the agreement, so that, you know, with the wheels of universities, particularly public universities, quite often turn very, very slowly and much slower than you can sometimes expect. Particularly as well if you're trying to recruit people from the outside, and what you've got to get the right fit, and sometimes that takes a longer time than you originally anticipate. So I think that having a discussion about that and relative to time horizon might have been helpful in Chicago's case without knowing any of the details. For this particular, for Mr. Culverhouse, I don't know what I would have done differently, except that if I was the board and I was discussing removing his name from the college and returning his gift, I would have moved a lot quicker than they did. And bureaucracy sometimes gets in the way, particularly for a public institution that has a large board of trustees. And the board of trustees does have a position the governor serves as ex officio board member of every state university that we have. But rarely does a governor show up at any of the meetings. I have only known of one governor in the 90s who did such. But that governor typically doesn't vote at the meetings. I think that their executive committee should have met immediately and taken care of it, because this donor was not just upset. This donor had felt alienated, and once you become alienated, I don't think there's any recovery from that. If he had just been upset, if I knew that was going on, say 3 months into the deal, I would have tried to meet with him and go over what parts of the agreement needs to be adjusted, what needs to be amended, what are we not doing, what shared vision do we need to, you know, how can we compromise here? Again, how can we meet in the middle? And that may have been done. I certainly know that something was going on, or there wouldn't have been a trail of emails going back and forth, right? So maybe they tried and failed.
So as we wind this down, land this plane, I guess is the way we could put that. As we try to land this, explain to me where does donor relations in a larger institution, because the donor relations role is in my guess it's a role that's unique to larger institutions. So where do you play? And I could be wrong on that, so correct me if I'm wrong. But where do you sort of play out in the continuum of fundraising?
Sure. Well, so at Birmingham Southern, it is a very small, small liberal arts college. And so I am just a one-person shop there. At UAB, I had five people, I believe, when I left, maybe six. Uh-huh. And so, yes, a large team versus a small team. At UAB, we were able to work with, and at Birmingham Southern, I am able to work with each individual major gifts officer to, as they build relationships with these donors, to learn them, to know about them and what is important to that donor. You can't just take a blanket and lay it across all donors and say, oh, this works. Each donor has a different personality, just like each cat or each puppy does. You know, right. I mean, not to compare them to animals, but it's like taking care of children, taking care of your family. And it is almost like family, and the relationships can be like a good marriage, or it could be like a really bad divorce.
So do you come on the scene? Do you come on? So I all my experience in-house in shops was in major gifts. So would you have come on the scene before the gift was received, or like when I was in DC as a gift officer, we had a, what they called a stewardship department. Are you and I interacting before the gift is even solicited?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. To ensure the relationship is managed appropriately from the start and that those expectations can be met. Many times in a donor relations and stewardship shop, there is one person or multiple people who know how things work, what the process is, who the key people are, and how to get in touch with those people and get them to sign off on the plan. Again, the play, their part in the play before the curtain goes up.
So I have to imagine your role is, especially as it applies to me, if I'm the major gifts officer, you're in almost like a coaching role. Am I right?
A little bit. Yes, I am. And I work with, it's just my job to make sure to think about outside of the box, creative thinking that will help, you know, help that donor feel the affinity and loyalty for your institution that you want them to.
Yeah. Well, Daphne, it has certainly been a pleasure to have you on. I've had your attention for about 25 minutes. People know how to find me. They can find me relatively easily. But if they have listened to our conversation today and they want to reach out to you, how might you suggest that they do that?
Sure. I'm on LinkedIn, Daphne B. Powell. And I am relationshippro007@gmail.com. So please feel free to reach out to me. A lot of consultants, I give away my time too much, but I do consulting on the side, but I'm also available for free advice.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. So you are available for some consulting. I was kind of interested in that, and I may invite you back. We'll have to invite you back to have a longer conversation about donor relations in particular, because as I said, it's just not a specialty area that I'm too familiar with. So it's certainly
been a pleasure.
I'd love to do
that. Same here, Jason. Thank you for having me.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.